everyone. I'm Michael Baer. I'm Program Coordinator with the National LGBT Cancer Network, and I'm going to be presenting on Cancer and the LGBT Community Summit and Action Plan. I have no relationships to disclose. So, unlike a lot of other health issues that we address, cancer is a little bit different in that it's a very complicated disease with multiple kinds of cancer, different kinds of treatments, and several different kinds of prognoses. We have reason to believe that they are all disproportionately affecting our community, but it's a complication that means that there are many points of entry, many different parts need fixing, and there's different disciplines that bring attention to the various parts of this complicated disease within our community. We've been using the metaphor of a decrepit house. Imagine it's falling apart. It needs roofing, it needs plumbing, it needs carpentry. So you bring all these people together, a carpenter, a plumber, a roofer, but if there's no general manager, someone to introduce all the people from the different areas and get the job done together, how's it going to work? So keep that metaphor in mind as I go forward, and it'll help. So cancer folks don't always know about LGBT needs, and LGBT health folks don't always understand our needs in the cancer care continuum. So I'm going to give you a short LGBT cancer 101 just to catch you up to speed. Knowing that we're all LGBT caucus members, I'm going to forego a longer discussion on minority health and discrimination as a social context of health, knowing that you'll understand when I bring that up when I'm talking about. So aside from cancer disparities that we're aware of, there's evidence suggesting other LGBT cancer disparities exist, but due to several reasons, which I'll bring up shortly, we don't have proper data on these yet. Cancer is often thought of as a continuum, as you'll see here, from prevention to screening and diagnosis, treatment, survivorship, and end-of-life and palliative care. And I'd like to talk about each of these individually and how they affect the LGBT communities. So barriers to care for LGBT people, of course, exist. Our cancer risks are not based on any physiological or genetic difference, but the issues on this slide highlight some of the most salient social and structural issues. Some LGBT cancer risks are behaviorally based. Our community has higher rates of tobacco and alcohol use, and this slide shows how increased use of tobacco and alcohol use are shared risks across the community. On the left-hand side, we see that lesbians and bisexual women have higher BMI and nulliparity, which is not having any children. And combined with increased smoking and alcohol use, this may be in part for the higher rate of breast cancer and other cancers within lesbian and bisexual women. Among researchers in breast cancer, this is something that's called the densest cluster of risk factors. While on the right, we see HIV and HPV for gay and bisexual men and trans women, along with increased alcohol and tobacco use, increases chances of a variety of cancers. Here's another slide that shows how these behaviors from the previous slide put us at greater risk for specific forms of cancer. I talked about breast cancer earlier, and with prostate cancer, you'll see there's a question mark or next to STIs. There is some evidence that prostate cancer may be promoted or caused by STIs, but the causal link has not been established like with HPV and certain kinds of cancers. So in terms of screening in the cancer care continuum, it's our decreased screening behavior across cancer types, which means malignancies may be caught later and be harder to treat. So moving from screening into treatment, many LGBT people have been rejected from the family of origin due to their sexual orientation and gender identity. For example, breast cancer survivors' support networks often included ex-girlfriends and lovers. We'd often see this among heterosexual people pulling their exes into their support network. And also people listed their pets and therapists as part of their support network, which we don't really see in the general population either. Also, discussions about sex, such as sexual functioning after prostate cancer treatment. In an online survey we conducted with LGBT cancer survivors across the country, one participant stated, "Luckily, my radiologist could talk about how my treatment might affect my sex life. He asked who was the top and who was the bottom." This is a great experience, but it's very uncommon. As well as some breast cancer survivors have felt coerced by the male gaze of body expectation during discussions of breast reconstruction. Alienation also occurs during treatment due to the gendering of cancer treatments. Research has shown that the pinking of breast cancer has been alienating to a lot of LGBT people, as well as the war on cancer, or let's battle cancer metaphors. So going back to our cancer care continuum, let's move on to survivorship. Even if LGBT people receive the same standard of care as the general population, our survivorship experiences are very different. LGBT survivors report lower qualities of life measures post-treatment, And of course, social contexts like isolation and internalized stigma are also part of this reason. One problem is the fact that our experts are siloed across research areas of interest in cancer along the care continuum, by population, by specific cancers, or within areas such as policy without talking to each other. And I know researchers who only work on survivorship within lesbian breast cancer survivors, others who work with anorectal cancer among HIV-positive men, while others work on getting better data collection at the federal level, but these researchers don't necessarily talk to each other. So as you can see what I said, this is like that house that's in disrepair. It has no general manager to kind of pull it all together. So now I'll give you a little bit of background about our summit. In 2011, my executive director, Liz Margulies, and researcher Jack Burkhalter from Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center started a conversation that became the nascent phase of the summit. Some of the reasons for the summit was, as I was saying, how researchers are siloed across areas. To bring these folks together was a major impetus so there could be this kind of cross-pollination of ideas and the work that was being done. Then we sought out funding, and we looked for scholarship money because it became clear that if we wanted all the participants that we wanted to come, we were going to need to secure proper funding. A planning committee was developed with representatives from the National LGBT Cancer Network, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, and Callan Lord. An action plan model was decided on to address the various issues and to bring these issues to policymakers across government and healthcare in a comprehensive way that addresses the variety of needs of LGBT people across the cancer care continuum. And like I said, we wanted to make this an incubator so people could really meet each other and know what each other were working on, because often they read each other's work and knew of each other, but they hadn't met, and everyone was equally starstruck. It was actually really nice to see. I just want to give a little bit of shout-out to our funders. We received generous funding from the Jerry and ME Fund and the Cancer Survivorship Initiative, both at Memorial Sloan Kettering, the Network for LGBT Health Equity, which has since become LGBT Health Link, and the Paulette Fund. When we were deciding on the structure of the meeting, we decided that it would be best to limit it to about 60 individuals, ranging from nurses, oncologists, social workers, researchers, policymakers, and survivors and advocates. If successful, the action plan would be used to catalyze progress in addressing the cancer needs for the LGBT community, providing a blueprint for funding, research, and programming. And the goal informed the proposed length and process of the summit, the two-day meeting for transdisciplinary guests to share learned and identified gaps within the LGBT community, which is split. Everyone was split into small structure groups, which I'll get to in the next slides, but we looked for identifying the gaps, rationale for healing the gaps, action to change the outcomes of the gaps, and anticipate the outcomes of these changes. On day one, we had several breakout groups. The first was organized so researchers, care providers, survivors, and policymakers could brainstorm on their areas of need. The second breakout session was along the cancer care continuum with prevention, screening, diagnosis and treatment, and survivorship people working together. And the last breakout group brought together subpopulations, lesbian and bisexual women, gay and bisexual men, and transgender people to discuss issues faced by their subgroup. We used these, what we call gap sheets, to record the data, and this shows how we intended the conversation to address gaps, actions, and outcomes. Here's an example of our gap sheet that we used. And here's a couple more examples. And it went down. It was about a three-page sheet, so we had a lot of information that we were working with. On day two, we had a plenary work group where we brought everyone together, and we discussed the process of the previous day. There was a discussion about who we were, and we developed kind of buckets or meta-themes of all the data that was gathered from all the experts across the areas. So our discussions about the process and who we are led to bigger issues and concerns about inclusion in the process, how we would make it more diverse going forward as various iterations of the action plan was being developed, and ways we could we need to highlight cross-cutting themes that could not be categorized into our meta-themes, one of which was other LGBT health disparities and how they may affect cancer care. Highlight intersectionality is an important aspect to how the work we were doing, so we could pay attention to race, class, ability, and a variety of other issues affecting LGBT people across the care continuum, and the need for visibility across all efforts, and of our community's unique risk factors outside of cancer care that may affect the care that we're getting. So now we're going to move on to our themes. Definitions, we were want to get LGBT defined as both a minority group and a medically underserved population at the federal level. In increasing inclusion and representation, we were talking about influencing policymakers, representation of LGBT in leadership and workforce, and collaborating with advocacy groups and LGBT groups. Our strategy, we were wanting to leverage success stories and examples from previous LGBT health wins, like things being done in HIV and other health activism. There's a lot of things around social context of health that HIV really worked out that we think we could adapt for cancer research. And we also wanted to figure out how young adults were defined by the federal government as a prioritized group. That was a shift from pathology to population level prioritization. We're hoping to get that done for LGBT people. We wanted more evidence-based research tied to clinical trials, theoretical frameworks, mixed methods research, and to add sexual orientation and gender identity questions to existing longitudinal studies. In terms of data collection, we were interested in surveillance and intake forms at cancer research centers, electronic medical records, including sexual orientation and gender identity, and then also at the SEER Cancer Registry. In care, we were interested in coordination with comorbidities across spectrum of cancers, as well as other issues LGBT people face, palliative care, advanced care, and end-of-life care with look at our special needs, redefining caregivers and support networks so we can really achieve the support that LGBT people need in cancer care, and also ICD classification, which was diagnosis codes are not inclusive enough, especially for trans people. With the gender change, they can't necessarily get the diagnostics they need for the body parts they have, whether they have a cervix or a prostate. If their ID says they're male, they can't always get a cervical exam because of the paperwork. And then education and training, workforce mentorship, and then also funding. We wanted to increase LGBT cancer research funding and programs in other areas. So after the summit, we had a delegation of post-summit writing to planning committee members. We talked about process. We set deadlines. We searched for appropriate publications, so it would be somewhere that could be highlighted but also make it available to everyone. And our hopes were that this could be used to influence federal and institutional policymakers to improve LGBT care and outcomes along the cancer care continuum. And here you see another image of the house. This is what we're hoping to achieve by bringing everyone together and really work together on all the disparate parts of the LGBT experiences and issues in the cancer care continuum so we can improve care and outcomes for LGBT folks in preventing and treating cancer. Thank you.
Our next speaker will be Hillary Glenn.